Hello, all. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whenever you're listening or watching this podcast episode. My name is Dr. Carla Ionescu, and welcome to the Goddess Project. Today, we are going to talk about goddesses who go to hell. I've been fascinated lately with how many cultures, in fact, almost all cultures, but we're going to cover about five or six or seven today, have goddesses that go to hell or run hell or go down into hell and come back up. And how many of those qualities and characteristics are quite similar for many of these goddesses? And I started putting something together just for fun, as this podcast tends to be for fun. And I thought, oh my God, there's so much here. So we are going to scratch the surface today. I'm thinking there's enough here, to be honest, to do an entire course on goddesses who go to hell. And as many of you who have been listening to me for some time know, I do run online courses through the Artemis Research Center. So if you want to see what courses are coming up for fall, please check us out. I'll put the link down in the description. And you can see what's coming up in the fall. And then we also have courses in the winter. But this concept of goddesses who go to hell and their characteristics, and we're also going to talk about some of the gods that go to hell, is really, really interesting to me. Anyways, I like, as many of you know, I like dark, I was going to say, I like dark monstrous stories and beings. I really like that. I think that there's something about us looking into that history that's very important. Some of you who are watching this probably also watched my episode with Juan on the One on One podcast. You can find it in the community posts. I've put a link there. And we start talking about Gorgons, and we're going to talk about them in more detail, actually in about a week or so. And we start talking about, and we start about the Horn Goddess and how, the that statue of the goddess with hair, kind of like mine, but maybe more like horns, got her head chopped off. Anyways, and it's just it makes me feel a little bit like we really need to dive deeper into darkness. And not being afraid of darkness, not judging it as evil automatically. And in fact, understanding that darkness, the afterlife, death, I don't know, soil, underground, all of the things that might trigger some kind of a fear reaction are actually part of life. In fact, they're half of life. Literally, night and day are half of our lives. So we really need to understand and face the mythologies that we have been taught to fear. So one of the things that I want to say before we move forward is that the goddesses that we are discussing today, and the gods a little bit on the side, are we're not feared in the sense that they were scary monsters, and we'll talk about that in a little more detail, but feared in their fierceness, right? In their fearsomeness. That is, they were powerful, they had agency, they ruled, of course, mostly death in the underworld. And so these were goddesses you honored. But if you honored them and you worshiped them and you respected them, you had nothing to fear from them. In fact, one could argue you needed their guidance, you needed their assistance in reaching the afterlife, or perhaps once you were in the underworld, you needed their kindness to preserve your afterlife and to allow you to have an afterlife that maybe was not too monstrous or torturous or etc. So this relationship was not one of monster fear, but one of respect and honor. Yeah. And so, what I want to do today is touch upon at least seven or eight goddesses from a few different cultures and talk a little bit about both what their responsibilities were, but also what are the common patterns that we are hearing. And one of the things that I want you to think about as you listen to this, or perhaps as you're reminded of some of these stories, because not all these stories are brand new, I want you to think about the way that you thought or think about death, number one, about the afterlife, about hell. We're going to talk about hell, about the underworld. First of all, what kind of imagery comes up? Second of all, what kind of emotion comes up? And I suppose overall, what are some of the things that you've been taught to believe about all of that? Yeah. So let's begin. Let's begin in my favorite place, which is, of course, Greece. So we're going to start with Persephone because I think number one, she's most familiar. Number two, she's still one of the most fascinating divinities. I am putting together, I have an online course that you kind of go through yourself on Persephone, which I love. So if you want to take a short online self-directed course that has readings and a few lectures and a few discussions, please take that course. You can see the link underneath this video. But I'm also working on one on Demeter, which I'm really excited about because I was able to go to Eleusis for the second time, but the museum was finally open. And in the museum, well, actually, the museum was closed, but the guy opened it for me because no one goes there. So I want to highly recommend that you go there if you're ever in Greece again. It is just outside of Athens. Please add it to your list. It is in Eleusina. Please go see the site where the Eleusinian Mysteries took place and also the Eleusina Museum. Anyways, the guy was there. He was very happy to have someone come. And within, so the museum has been renovated. It's beautiful. In fact, this piece that you see here, if you're watching me on YouTube, if not, that's okay, is Persephone and Hades. And they are often depicted, of course, together, but often depicted at a funeral festival. So, like parties that would be offered for the dead. And of course, Persephone and Hades, you're not surprised, are the reigning divinities in which the humans are making offerings to and hoping that their loved one that has passed away is welcomed into the underworld and treated well. So, and sorry, I got a little bit distracted. And what I found really fascinating about the museum is that they have an entire section, let's say, kind of walk through it that takes you through the most recent details that we have about what was going on at the Eleusinian or Eleusinian mysteries. And I'm really excited to, I took all the notes, I took all the pictures, and I'm really excited to share that with you guys in an upcoming online course on Demeter, because I was like, woohoo, this is more than what we know online, you know what I mean? It's very, very exciting in the details. Anyways, though there's still a lot of mystery around it. And so the relationship of Demeter and Persephone are fascinating and is one that keeps coming up over and over. In short, for those of you who may not be familiar with Persephone, she is the daughter of Demeter. She is abducted by Hades and she becomes the queen of the underworld. And there is an entire episode that I did on Demeter and Persephone about mothers and daughters that I encourage you to watch if this is a story that really interests you. Because what's really fascinating for me about this story is that it's told in a patriarchal way. That is, Hades steals Persephone, which is the catalyst of the story. Demeter is lost and wondering, you know, and sad without her daughter. Zeus, finally intervenes after Demeter, you know, almost destroys all of Greece because she doesn't let the harvest happen and all of the stories. What I mean is that it seems like the men are in control. Hades takes, Zeus gives, etc. But in practice, Demeter and Persephone are a powerhouse beyond anything that Hades or Zeus could do. And perhaps, I mean, and logically, this is probably why they were abducted, Persephone is abducted or taken by Hades, and Zeus gives permission for her or convinces Hades to bring her back for half the year. It's probably because they were so powerful in the culture. So Demeter and the Eleusinian Mysteries are date back, predate certainly the Greeks. And there's an argument that they predate the Hellenes. And Persephone, if some of you have seen that video that I made, oh, actually, I don't know if I put it on YouTube. I think it was on TikTok. When I went to the Temple of Despoina, which is a word for mistress, Persephone was so powerful that they often wouldn't say her name. Yeah. And they would call her mistress because they were afraid of her looking at them. Yeah. You know, when someone calls your name, in fact, there's this whole psychology about if people know your name, they have more control over you. You're walking down the street and someone says, "Hey, Carla," and you turn and you look, right? And there's this whole psychology around power in knowing someone's name. And there's an old mythology that if you know a god's real name, which they usually hide, you can control them. Well, in the case of Persephone, I mean, Isis with Ra and all that kind of stuff, we're going to talk about Isis in a minute. But in the case of Persephone, what's amazing to me is that they know her name clearly, Kore, Persephina, Persephone, however you want to say it. And they're too afraid to call her by her name. And so they call her Despoina, or they call her Mistress. And the Temple of Despoina, which I would like to do a whole episode on, first of all, is so rarely open, and we got to see it, which is a long story of how lucky we were and how the goddess has guided us to this place. My friend Sandra and I, you know, we're doing this mapping, Artemis mapping temple, and you won't be surprised that, of course, Artemis is also at the Temple of Despoina because Artemis is everywhere. But the Temple of Despoina is a very rare place to visit, so we went to go visit this place, and there are so many local mysteries that claim that in fact this temple was there before the moon. You know, there's this kind of saying the temple was there before the moon, and there's this so what that really means, other than a temporal time, like it's been here for a very long time, but what that really means is that it was here when everything was dark, when everything was night, right? And we're going to talk about Nyx in a second, which is the goddess of night, when everything was primordial, right? Because it's in the darkness that we are all born. I mean, we in the womb itself, we're in the darkness. Yes, I mean, okay, maybe if your mom's sitting in sunlight and tanning herself, you may have some light, you know, as an embryo, as an infant, as a baby in your mother's belly. But in it's the womb is darkness, the cosmos is darkness, the earth is darkness, caves are darkness. So creative ability is in the darkness. And so the story about this temple of Despoina, the mistress, where of course Demeter, Persephone, and Artemis ruled, remains a mystery. Very rarely visited, very rarely open. They have a tiny museum in there. Actually, I will do an episode on that because it's just so fascinating. And they had these colossal statues. And it's, you know, the temple is on a mountain, really sort of in the middle of nowhere, I want to say. I mean, it's not in the middle of nowhere, you know, but it is like it's on the side of a mountain. Anyways. That will be a story for another day. But it ties into this idea that Persephone was so feared that they would not say her name. Yeah. And then we learn from the story, of course, of Hades' abduction, so to speak. Although actually, Hades is not at the Temple of Despoina, though there is a Plutonium in Eleusis and Eleusina, where there's the sort of half cave that's called the Plutonium, which is where people believed that you can make offerings to Hades or Pluto and Persephone. Anyways, so he has like a little side thing beside her because the counterpart of Persephone, of course, is Hades. And Hades is often seen as the king of the underworld, you know, and he really just stays in the underworld. He guards the dead. He's kind of a not nice person. And he apparently doesn't like mortals. Okay. And he's always depicted actually in modern culture as this kind of skeletal, gross kind of figure. And I did a whole episode on the relationship of Hades and Persephone, you're not surprised, and the sort of dark romance of it all. But his while he isn't, I mean, I'm not saying go disrespect Hades, do not, yeah. But in fact, do not disrespect any of the divinities, because who knows, right? But he is not as feared, and he is not as involved in the community and in the communal rituals. And he doesn't have temples to himself. Now you might say, well, of course, he's underground. But Persephone has many temples. And Demeter, of course, has many, many temples. And not only that, for the temples themselves, but their statues, their the votive offerings, the figurines of Demeter and Persephone are everywhere, not just in Greece, in Italy, and all over the Mediterranean and the Middle East. You have the mother-daughter figurines, the mother-daughter goddesses. So the impact of the goddess of the underworld is significantly more measurable than the god of the un than the god or the king of the underworld, right? So if we look at Persephone and Hades, we can say that Persephone it represents the cycle of life and death, and she is linked to the changing of the seasons, of course, because of her annual return in the spring and then goes down into the underworld in the fall. Well, Hades is the ruler, the king of the dead. And he oversees the minerals of the underworld, and he kind of guards the mortals there. So we can already see a little bit of a development of the goddess, the queen, seems much more involved in the cycle of life, death, nature, humans, fertility, etc. Okay. Now let's move on to Hecate, or Hecate, as the Greeks say. Yeah. Hecate is again a goddess on which I will do a separate episode on, but I want to include her here. Of course, I mean, you can't talk about the underworld or dark goddesses or goddesses who go to hell without talking about Hecate, especially in Greece. So Hecate is the goddess of magic, witchcraft, sometimes like the supernatural, ghosts, spirits, etc. She is often depicted with three faces. Okay. There's great debate. It's great debate now on this concept of the three faces representing mother, maid, sorry, maid, mother, crone, those three stages of life. And that has been a popular idea for a long time, but that is starting to be really questioned, mostly because most of the statues that we see, which we call a hecaton, we of the three goddesses, don't have. They don't, their faces don't age. They don't have, it's not maid, mother, or crone on there. It's the same face, but they have three different characteristics. So there's lots of talk about this trinity, whether it's, and I actually have been doing some work on the Artemis Triad, and I know some of you have already heard of this, where the three faces actually represent Hecate, Artemis, and Selene, and we recognize them by sort of what they hold in their hands. But they don't have to be only the Artemis Triad or those three, although they are often interlinked. They can be any aspect of life, death, magic, lots of aspects that involve light, darkness, sleep, lots of aspects of threes that remain somewhat of a mystery to us as academics. Because Hecate is so often represented with, pharmakeia, magic, the crossroads, right? The crossroads are often, of course, literally a cross. And so there used to be, for example, you could put this three-faced goddess, the Hecatomb, you could put it in the middle of the crossroads or at a crossroads as an offering. So there's lots of mysteries around that. And I'm not saying that it is not the three phases of life. It could be. It could totally be the three phases of life. But what I'm saying is that it's not only, and that Maid Mother Crone is a later explanation, interpretation of the three-faced goddess. Yeah. But we've got lots of three, we've got three graces, we've got three fates, we got three, lots of three goddesses. In fact, my argument has been, as some of you know, that the original Trinity or concept of the Trinity, which remember is a triangle and actually an upside down triangle, is the pubic triangle. So the original three have always been goddesses or female, like a feminine energy. And then, you know, later on with Christianity, they adapted that Trinity, or they took that Trinity and placed, you know, put God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit on it, right? God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost. And they sort of, you know, replaced the three goddesses with that. But it has always been a symbol of power. So Hecate, you might ask yourself, who is she? Well, Hesiod tells us, of course, that she is honored exceedingly by the deathless gods. And of course, Kronos makes her the nurse of the young, you know, I mean, sorry, Zeus makes her a nurse of the young. This overlaps her responsibilities with Artemis, and she's also a goddess of the night, et cetera, et cetera. She's, you know, the Orphic hymns, like there's a hymn to Hecate that says, Hecate, Aenodea, lovely dame of earthly, watery, and celestial frame, attend our sacred rites and come benign with favorite heart to the incense now divine. So she is also a goddess to be feared. If you practice any worship for Hecate, you must be careful. And actually, let me tell you a little short story. When I was in Corfu, my friend's house, the place where I stayed, was at a crossroads. And for some reason, within arriving there, I knew that I had to make an offering at this crossroads to Hecate. And Hecate has not really been a part of my life or even my study too much, other than her association with Artemis. But for some reason, in this place, at this crossroads, there was like a demand, like a, you need to go and offer something. And I did. Now you have to be very, very careful what you offer gods in the ancient world. For example, underworld gods, goddesses, especially chthonic, what we call chthonic goddesses and gods, do not receive alcohol. Okay, so do not make offerings of wine or alcohol to chthonic gods. Now this is really interesting because in my culture, for example, in the Romanian culture, and it's become part of all the cultures, when you honor the dead, right, you pour a little bit of booze, right? For example, my grandmother really liked whiskey. So when I honor her, not that I drink whiskey, but if I ever did have a glass of whiskey, I would pour a little bit to my grandmother. And then there are other people that pour other types of alcohol to their lost ones. And that's fine. That's totally fine. But the gods of the underworld, particularly Hecate and particularly the Greek gods, they do not like alcohol. And there's lots of literature to support this. What they like, actually, is sweet things, particularly honey, but sweet things. So I had to find, so what I did is I found the most delicious a homemade eclair, kind of like an eclair, like a Greek eclair, okay? Spread stuffed with some delicious stuff at one of the bakeries in Corfu. And then I smothered it in honey. Yeah, it's like a big thing. And I offered that at the crossroads. And I didn't know that actually the night that I made this offering, because I have too many things in my brain sometimes, and I don't always pay attention to the ancient calendar of worship unless it's to do with Artemis. I know Artemis's month is in May, and I know when her birthday is and things like that. But the night that I made this offering was the night before the beginning of the month of Hecate, which is the month of July. And there's a whole celebration to Hecate. I think it's about 3 weeks. Anyways. So I read that actually the next day, you know, on social media. There's a couple of accounts that I follow that actually are calendars of the ancient world. And I thought, holy crap, what a fascinating connection, because I was driven that I had to go out at night You know, it was 11 p.m. At a crossroad, which you can imagine, lots of cars are driving by. Okay, and I thought, these people are gonna think I'm nuts. Like, here I am in this long kind of nightgown outside of the property, right? Like outside of the property gates, in the middle of this, not in the middle, not literally, you don't want to stand in the middle of a crossroads with Greeks driving, but you know, on the side, but in the, you know, there's this crossroads, right? So you're kind of on the side, but all the cars are going by you and they're coming close. And here I am trying to find a moment between cars driving by to make my offering and to give Hecate this sweet treat in thanks for protecting and watching over me while I lived near her crossroads. Anyways, it's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful moment. And then to find out the next day that this is the beginning of her month was just, I don't know, synchronicity, as we say. Yeah. And Hecate, actually, despite the fact that she's quite frightening in many depictions, she is actually a guide and a protector. And this is why she's at crossroads, because at crossroads, both symbolically and literally, you have to make a decision which way you go. And she guides you if she likes you. And if she doesn't, you're in a lot of trouble. But if she likes you, she guides you on the right road, on the right path. Yeah. And in fact, Hecate plays a key role for Persephone as a protector. Although, and in fact, when they're looking for her, Hecate goes down into the underworld looking for her, right? So we have these stories that Hecate can cross these liminal spaces between life and death. Demeter doesn't go down into the underworld because Demeter is the representation of life, but Hecate goes down into the underworld. And in fact, is one of the people that realizes Persephone is there. The depiction of the three faces, like I said, could very much be anything from maid, mother, crone. Like I said, that was the sort of the idea in the last 500 years or so. Heaven, earth, sea, those are also three things, and all other sort of mysteries and magics and darkness and night. Yeah. Now, she doesn't actually have a counterpart. Hecate doesn't have a husband, doesn't have a partner, doesn't have anything. But sometimes, as her, let's say, a male, I don't want to say it's a male version of Hecate because that would be an insult to poor Hecate, but I would say that another god who acts as a psychopomp in the way that Hecate sometimes does, as a guide for souls into the underworld, is Hermes. Hermes is a messenger god. He also sometimes guides souls to the underworld, but he's not really an underworld deity. You know, he prefers not to do that, where Hecate gladly and openly not only can go into the underworld at any time, but also guides souls into the underworld. So she actually does not have a counterpart, but I would say if you're looking for sort of what is a male version, of guiding souls to the underworld, because that's all that Hermes does as far as the chthonic aspect. He likes to spend his time actually causing a lot more trouble to the living than the dead. Yeah. Next, I would like to introduce you to Nyx. Yeah, so Nyx is a primordial goddess of the night. We don't talk enough about Nyx. We really, really don't. And we really, really, really should. So she is a goddess of darkness, shadow. She is one of the first beings, according to Greek mythology, to emerge at the dawn of creation. Well, of course she does, right? If you think about the Christian story of Genesis, a Judeo-Christian Islamic story, okay? If you think about Genesis 1, Yahweh, the first thing he does is say, "Let there be light." Right? Which implies that there is darkness, right? So that actually means that before there was anything, perhaps even Yahweh, in fact, between you and me, definitely before there was Yahweh, there was darkness, night, in this case, Nyx. Okay? So again, we come back to this idea that in the darkness is actually where creation occurs, where creativity occurs, where power resides. Okay. So according to Hesiod, Nyx, of course, is the mother of Aether and Day, whom she bore after coupling with Erebus. So her partner is Erebus. And excuse me. She actually dwells, she actually lives in the dark halls of Hades. According to Homer, she is there all of the time, and she dwells among the souls of the dead. Yeah. Now, interestingly, Nyx is the mother of many, many so-called terrors, things that frightened the Greeks. So Hypnos, for example, Thanatos, she's the mother of Thanatos, the Moirai, all of these, again, all of these concepts, mythological concepts that come out of darkness. She is older than even Gaia, which is, of course, Earth. And clearly she is older than Yahweh. So powerful that even Zeus fears her, right? There's an instance, for example, there's a story when Hypnos really annoys Zeus. So Hypnos is the god of sleep. He really annoys Zeus, and Zeus is trying to chase him down with a thunderbolt, and Hypnos goes and hides in Nyx or beside Nyx. Imagine her as this concept of night and darkness, and Zeus does not dare enter. Does not dare enter her realm, does not dare bother her. So we have this powerful primordial. And when I say primordial, I mean a divinity that is alive before anything else exists. Now, her counterpart, sometimes her consort, right, is Erebus. Or Erebus. When I say consort, consort is, how do I explain consort? Well, you know what consort means. Me trying to figure it out. So, if a queen or king have a consort, it's almost like it's not really a husband, it's not really a partner, but it is someone that is favored and often is a lover and often has attachment to the ruler of whatever realm. So Erebus is the consort of Nyx, and together, you know, they personify dark and shadowy aspects of existence. But and so the Erebus is part of the process of her birthing day and night and Thanatos and all these other divinities. But he comes after, right? He comes after. He is born out of night. Okay, so this idea that night parthenogenetically creates her own consort, which is kind of how Gaia creates Uranus, for example, right? Like Gaia is around way before Uranus is born, and in fact, she's the one that creates him, and then he becomes her consort. So this is an old parthenogenetic concept of creation. Again, because Nyx is the very source of creation, because she's this darkness, she's this, imagine like dark, fertile soil, right? Like when you're growing something, even when you have your garden, you want the darkest soil because that it has the most minerals and is the most healthiest soil. And so imagine that Nyx is not just night and darkness, but this dark, sort of earthy soil. And from there, she can birth whatever she wants. And she births many things. And one of them is her consort, with which then she births other beings. So this idea, so we've got, so far we've got Persephone in the other world. Hecate, that is a liminal goddess. She goes between day and between this life and the other. And of course, Nyx, which is sort of the embodiment of all darkness. So the Greeks have these three divinities that are three goddesses for the underworld, three goddesses that have power over hell. Yeah? Okay. But what about some other creatures? And so I'm going to, the creatures. Ooh, sorry, goddesses. I mean, goddesses. So I'm going to start with one of my favorite Mesopotamian divinities, which is Eresh-Ki-Gal. I absolutely love Eresh-Ki-Gal. I more than Inanna-Ishtar. I'm sorry for all of you Inanna-Ishtar worshippers. I like Inanna-Ishtar. No hate there. But I find Eresh-Ki-Gal just fascinating and powerful. And, you know, She is the queen of the underworld, just like Persephone. So now you might be seeing more of a pattern about me than perhaps the goddesses, but she is the queen of the underworld. She rules over the land of the dead. She plays a key role, of course, in Inanna's descent. But she is, again, the leader, the powerhouse behind the realm of the dead. I mean, she is the one to which everyone listens to. Not to say that her consort slash maybe husband Nergal doesn't have his own power. I mean, he's the god of war and death and pestilence. Okay. So again, you get this kind of, I want to say that the male divinities that are chthonic divinities or underworld divinities are very one-dimensional, right? They don't have complexities or three-dimensional abilities. They have sort of a duty. Oh, that's a good word. They have a duty and a responsibility, and that's it. That's what they do, and they're very singularly focused, perhaps like most men. Yeah. Multitasking is not their skill. Okay. And the multitasking becomes the rule and the realm of the queens. And because of that, I think the queens of the underworld, the goddesses of death and afterlife, are able to both permeate living culture, whether it's the earth or people, permeate living culture, and yet maintain this kingdom in the underworld. So they're able to multitask these two spaces, right? And as you know, Eresh-Ki-Gal is in the underworld, pregnant with Nergal's baby, when Inanna decides that she wants to come down and take over. And I did a whole episode on Inanna, and of course, Eresh-Ki-Gal is part of that. That talks about my interpretation of Inanna's descent into the underworld. In the story of Inanna's descent of the underworld, Eresh-Ki-Gal is depicted as such from the great above. Okay, Inanna sets her mind towards the great below. The goddess from the great above set her mind to the great below. So the great below is, of course, Eresh-Ki-Gal. Eresh-Ki-Gal, the queen of the underworld, who sometimes, for example, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, laments about someone coming in and bringing forth light. And so then sometimes when we think about Inanna's descent, people interpret it as Inanna sort of going into her dark shadow self. Although that is a Jungian interpretation, not really my interpretation of the text, because the ancients didn't have Jungian interpretations of their own text. But the idea that Inanna goes down into the underworld and is challenged by her sister, and in fact is punished by her sister severely. One could argue killed by her sister, although she's rejuvenated later on, makes Eresh-Ki-Gal the great below, right? It in fact makes Eresh-Ki-Gal stronger, more powerful than Inanna in this realm. Now, Eresh-Ki-Gal does not make it up to the, she doesn't come up to challenge Inanna ever. That's not her story. But she rules so powerfully, yeah, so powerfully, that she defeats Inanna, who arguably is one of the most powerful goddesses of Mesopotamia. Now, the interesting part about Nergal, which is Eresh-Ki-Gal's husband, is that he has this power over anger, right? War, anger, fighting, and he has the ability to turn people's hearts to stone, right? And that he's full of rage and he's full of anger, and he's killed, right? He's killed in the Epic of Gilgamesh, and Eresh-Ki-Gal is left to rule the underworld on her own, and so I think this is what is really fascinating. Nergal is a consort as well. He is not a husband and he's not a king, right? He is a consort often. Now, again, There may be different interpretations of that, depends on who you ask. But certainly Erishkigal is the queen, the ruler, the highest authority in the underworld. She embodies the inevitable nature of death. Okay? And then, of course, it makes sense that the god of war and destruction becomes Erishkigal's consort. But eventually, anyways, he is killed and Erishkigal is left on her own. So let's talk then about her sister Inanna. Now, Inanna is fascinating because she is a goddess of love and war. So this is what I mean about Inanna being arguably one of the most powerful divinities, despite, biological representation. But she is one of the most powerful divinities in the ancient world because she encompasses light and dark. Yeah. Light and dark. And she is so powerful that the reason why she goes to see Ereshkigal is because she wants to take over. She's like, you know what? I rule the earth and all of the cosmic realm. I think I'm gonna go down there and also rule the underworld, right? And in the Epic of Gilgamesh, we're told that Inanna went down to the underworld and sought the throne of her sister Ereshkigal. So she wants to conquer her sister. But this is what I mean about this relationship is that she can't, right? And so this is why I'm saying that Erishkigal is just so fascinating. Yeah. Now, Inanna Ishtar does not have a particular consort. I mean, we're told sometimes that she has several consorts, and she certainly wants to seduce Gilgamesh, and all this kind of stuff is said about her. But Nergal also is someone that she tries to seduce to do her bidding. And so Inanna Ishtar is a goddess that has, I would say, a variety of consorts or lovers, but is not tied to any one of them. Yeah. In fact, let's be honest. In Mesopotamia and these goddesses, there none of them are tied to husband, king, etc. Right? So consorts and lovers is more the right word. And for Inanna Ishtar, Nergal is also one of them sometimes. So Mesopotamia arguably has, I mean, I don't know. You'd have to make up your own mind, actually, now that I'm thinking about it and we're talking about it. But I was going to say Mesopotamia has the most independent, but now I'm thinking about it, I may be wrong, of the Chthonic goddesses is what I mean. That they seem to be particularly independent. Let me know what you think in the comments, yeah, whether or not that's true. But Mesopotamia has this fascinating history with these two goddesses, of course, one that rules the outer world, let's say in the cosmos and everything really in it, and then the one that Ereshkigal, who rules the underworld. So here we have two feminine sides of a yin yang relationship. Let's move on to Egypt. Yeah, so I've taken you through Greece a little bit. We've gone to Mesopotamia. Let's move over a little bit to Egypt and let's talk about a couple of the goddesses here. Here again, we have a culture that has deep rituals and celebrations and performances for Chthonic goddesses and gods. With Chthonic goddesses. And of course, we're starting with Isis. There is a whole episode on Isis. Please feel free to watch that so that we can talk about there about all of the complexities of Isis's worship. But here, what I find fascinating about Isis so far is that she is a goddess of magic, motherhood, and the underworld. So again, you see this pattern of blending. This is what I mean about multitasking. Here you have another goddess that is, oh, and she does resurrection because she resurrects Osiris, right, and gives birth to Horus. So again, here we have the divine feminine able to access life and death. Now, you might be watching this or listening to me and going, well, duh, like it's women. Of course, we are at the gates of life and death. And in the ancient world, ancient Neolithic world, or post-Neolithic world, We have lots of stories of this, especially indigenous stories or tribal stories, in which women's bodies were literally seen as the gateways between life and death. So I know you're not surprised, and especially if you've been with me for a while, I know you're like, yeah, that makes sense. But what we're doing today is we're really seeing this pattern expand so widely that we have to ask ourselves, what has happened that this is no longer part of our culture? Like, think about monotheistic culture, for example, Judeo-Christianity, Islam. There is no, first of all, there's no female representation of the divine unless we're talking about the Virgin Mary, okay, Mary Magdalene, okay, as you can, those are butchered characters in that story, and there's a few other great women in the stories, Judith, Esther, etc., other women, but there are no powerful, dark, scary women. There are no more. And I hope what this episode is doing is showing you how prolific they were and how normalized this was, that and how celebrated actually it was. I mean, ISIS is celebrated, arguably one, the most celebrated divinity of the Egyptian pantheon, and the one that survives the longest because she survives well into the Roman period. And one could argue she continues surviving past the Roman period as well. So these divinities, when we see them like this, put one beside the other, I hope really clarifies that the dark feminine is celebrated and that darkness, the underworld, the afterlife, is not to be feared, honored and respected, like we said, but not to be feared. So Isis is fantastic for that because she's a very loving mother. She plays a, you know, her consort Osiris, her husband, brother, right? Complicated. She puts him back together and resurrects him, right? Breathes life back into him for a time, enough that she's able to have sex with him and create Horus. And then Osiris, of course, becomes the god of the afterlife and resurrection. And Osiris is basically kind of like a Hades. He doesn't come up very often. He doesn't come up above, I mean, out of the underworld very often. He's very much a god that stays in the underworld. He's very much a god that is worshipped for his underworld afterlife qualities, benefactoring, etc. But Isis is able to travel between these two paths, right? Isis is, in fact, not just able to go to the underworld, but she is able to pluck a divine soul. Soul, essence, etc., and spring it up and put it into the body of her husband, Osiris, and make it productive, right? So, I mean, think about that. Think of a god who can do that. There are no male gods that do this. Not one male god that can pluck the soul from the underworld, stick it into a whole body, and produce, in this case, an offspring. In fact, for Osiris, he's sort of a bystander in this story because he's just lying there, mostly dead, as she's put him back together. And then the soul is kind of stuck into him, and then they have this intimate moment. So he's, and then he, you know, he's, because he had died, he basically has to go back to the underworld. So he's really sort of a passive partner here. And in fact, remains a judge, right? Like his, again, he has a very singular duty, which is be a judge. And I mean, there's other characters that play a role in deciding whether or not a soul makes it into the afterlife in Egyptian culture, measuring the heart, all of this kind, you know, crossing the river, all of this kind of stuff. Osiris is just a judge. So he sort of sits on top and makes sure that everyone else is doing their job and that the souls are ferried where they need to be. So again, he has a singular responsibility. While ISIS, of course, has numerous responsibilities of love and war and mothering and sisterly duties and queen duties and politic duties and, of course, staying connected to the underworld through Osiris. So, again, we see this really fascinating character of resurrection and protection. And Osiris, also a god of death and fertility and ruler of the underworld, but much more, plays much more of a key role as a judge. In fact, that's his major role, right, is a judge. I thought we'd also talk about a couple other Egyptian goddesses, maybe lesser known goddesses. Nephthys, of course, is the sister of Isis and Osiris. And she is often a protective deity that is associated with the dead. So she actually helps Isis in the resurrection of Osiris. So she's sort of a secondary god, not secondary, but she's the, you know, the sister of the main, of the queen, right? And so lots of pyramid texts. For example, there's a pyramid text in which Nephthys says, I am the sister of the god. My hair is plaited. I am Isis. I am Nephthys. So there's sort of this overlap of sisterhood. The Book of the Dead, for example, there's a quote that says, Isis comes, Nephthys comes, one of them is at the head, one of them is at the feet of Osiris. So there's this collaborative aspect to Nephthys. I would say that Nephthys is associated with mourning, sadness, the protection of the dead, and particularly with funerary rites. Her counterpart, though they are not always connected, but her counterpart is Anubis, not her partner, but Anubis is the god of mummification and afterlife. He's the guardian of the tomb. He's the guide of souls. So Nephthys, I think, would be on equal par with him in some ways. They kind of stand opposite. So, for example, Nephthys stands in the living world and she's in charge of the, like I said, the mourning and the funerary rites and making sure that everything's okay, although she has resurrective power. And Anubis stands on the afterlife side, right, on the other side of the veil, as we would say, making sure that the mummification is done right and that the tombs are guarded and the souls are guided into the place where they want to be. So they are, so Nephthys is, again, another divine feminine that is part of the afterlife or darkness or underworld aspect. And one that is less known is the wife of Anubis himself. And this is why I said Nephthys and Anubis are not husband and wife, but Anubis actually has a wife. Her name is Anput. And we don't often talk about Anput, although I think she's also quite fascinating. She's a lesser known deity, especially for people who don't study Egyptology. So the wife of Anubis, she is also a protector of the dead. And she is also, she in the coffin texts, for example, or in some of the coffin texts, there are inscriptions to her that call her Lady of the Sacred Land, who guides the dead to the eternal rest. So I want you to think about just the numbers here. So we've got Isis, Nephthys, and Anput. Okay. And then we've got Osiris and Anubis. So already we have three goddesses to two. Not that it's a competition. And what I mean is like major arcana, like we would call it, right? Like high pantheon gods. There are other gods, other divinities that do other parts of the work that are important. But these five, let's say, play this fundamental role in Egyptian tradition, in Egyptian culture and Egyptian religion, which is basically actually focused on the afterlife. So from the day that you're little, you are focusing on making sure that you get into the afterlife. It's almost like Egyptians lived to die. Do you know what I mean? It's a very different kind of culture in the sense that they planned, they saved, they organized, whatever, to prepare for the afterlife. And of course, if you were super wealthy, that's very evident for us in all the archaeology that we found. But if, even if you weren't wealthy, we have lots of evidence, for example, of sarcophagi that is being reused, or that sarcophagi that was built for someone that was wealthy and that then didn't want it, and then they sold it for a, you know, like a lower price to someone who couldn't afford it. So what I mean is, like, the entire culture, the entire community thought about the afterlife, which means that these gods, especially these three goddesses that we're talking about, are fundamental to the very identity of the community, and particularly are trusted with the responsibility of taking care of the dead so that they can be sent to, or sent to the afterlife, to Osiris and Anubis, and others that are there to protect them and take care of them. So again, the multitasking of the goddesses becomes more and more and more clear. And while I think Anubis, again, Anubis, how do I say this? Is guardian, right? Of course, he's the goddess, he's the god of mummification and the guardian of tombs. His role is very much about transport. Yeah. So if we're going to give him a modern name, he makes sure that the package is wrapped safely. He makes sure that it's secured and sent to where it's supposed to be. He makes sure that it arrives at the right place. Okay. And that's it, right? Then he returns to get the new package, right? So his responsibility is transport. Very important transport, I'll give you that. But again, very singular responsibility, right? Very powerful divinity, don't get me wrong. But very singular responsibility for the afterlife, for this major aspect of the Egyptian's life. Now I'm going to take you forward in time and south. Yeah. We're going to go to the Aztecs. Yeah. And we're going to look at a goddess who is the queen of the underworld, whose name is Mictlantecuhtli. And Mictlantecuhtli is the queen of Mictlan, the underworld. And she oversees the bones of the dead, as well as presiding over the festivals of the dead. Okay. So Mictlantecuhtli, I love this name. Mictlantecuhtli is, according to Codex, to the Codex Borgia, seated on her throne in the underworld, watching over the bones of the departed. And so she presides over, so she is the queen of the underworld. You're seeing a pattern here, presiding over the souls of the dead, responsible for the souls of the dead. And she has a husband, Mictlantecuhtli. Mictlantecuhtli. Is her husband. He also sits on the throne and guards the bones of the underworld. Okay. So, and in fact, their names, as you can imagine, are very so. Mictlan, okay, hold on. Mictlantecuhtli and Mictlantecuhtli are these two partners in Aztec culture that take care of the underworld. Now, according to some traditions, she is the authority and he is the side authority. I don't want to say side authority, that doesn't make sense. But she is to be more feared. She is often more represented. She is sculpted more. You find her more so for example, we would say that he rules alongside her. Okay. So she is the queen and he is sort of the lord. Does that make sense? So again, you're not surprised to see that in Aztec culture, and Aztec culture is much, much later than, of course, Mesopotamian culture and even Hellenic culture. So the primordialness of the goddess of the underworld here, the goddess of so-called hell, we're going to talk about hell herself, is has had much more time to be changed by patriarchal sentiment. Okay. Now, I don't want to put on the Aztecs all of that sort of history of patriarchy, but I do want us to understand that time matters. And, one could argue, for example, that the Aztecs lived 2,000 years later than the Sumerians, the Assyrians, almost 1,500 years or so past the Babylonians. So, in that time, the concept of queens of underworld remains clear, which is fascinating, remains powerful. But this concept of queen and consort becomes more and more and more significant. So, in the Aztec world, we've got a queen and lord who are sharing the responsibility of the underworld. And in this case, both of them are sharing the responsibility of the underworld. What I mean by that is that she is not a goddess of the outer world or the world. She is firmly in the underworld, as is he. So what we've seen in earlier times, for example, is goddesses who walk, what we would call chthonic goddesses, although she is also a chthonic goddess, but they walk both the living and the dead. And in this case, this is more about guardianship of the dead. Although, like I said, there's lots of research continuing to happen, continue to be going on, particularly around Aztec culture. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all if we trace the roots of Mictlantecuhtli to an earlier connection with a goddess that perhaps walks both worlds. Wouldn't be surprised at all. Moving a little bit east now, I cannot talk about a goddess of the underworld without talking about Kali. And I know that many of you are familiar with Kali and have heard about Kali. Certainly, I am not an expert in Kali or in the Hindu, just as I'm not an expert in the Aztec tradition. There's lots of experts for that. But the purpose of this episode is patterns, right? And to see these patterns cross-culturally and cross-temporally. And so Kali is, you cannot talk about the underworld or regeneration or resurrection or transformative power of destruction without talking about Kali, particularly the darkness and the creation in the darkness, as we've talked about, without mentioning, of course, Kali. So Kali is said to have sprung forth from the brow of the goddess Durga. She was fierce with flames and weapons and loves to defeat demons. So she is a goddess that is often to referred to as the Dark One, who dances on the battlefield of life and death, and her laughter echoes through the cosmos. Yeah. So this Kali is actually a goddess that we could spend an entire year on, I think, because the complexities of her representations as destruction and creation, time, transformation, death, but not as a ruler of the underworld. Yeah, so she is not, so she is fascinating because she is not a ruler of the underworld, and yet she is so associated with death, destruction, and regeneration. So we see here how multi-layered the dark feminine, the divine feminine, can be, right? A counterpart to Kali, for example, can be Yama, God Yama, who is the god of death and the underworld. He again, though, Yama is a judge. Yeah. So he is a judge that determines the fate. He is very much Anubis. He is very much Hades, right? I was going to say he's not even Erebus, doesn't really even judge anything, but he is a judge. So you notice this pattern that the men are judges. Now, is this a patriarchal pattern? I don't know. I mean, clearly these are remnants or survivors of patriarchal control. And so what I mean is even the male divinities have been affected by this political regime of patriarchy, which is about 2,000 years old. So in the two, maybe, okay, let me give you 4,000 years old. Let's go back a little bit further. Yeah, okay, I'm comfortable with 4,000 years. But what I'm saying is that even the male divinities have been affected by this sort of social political system. So where was I going with that? Well, oh yeah, so that they are made into judges. Perhaps the position of judging is quite important. One could argue, yes, it's very important who judges you and whether or not you where you go in the afterlife. But Yama, for example, cannot compete with the multi-layer complexities of someone like Kali, whose divinity has existed, you know, 5, 6, 7,000 years old, and continues to inspire today, continues to be a significant figure, not just in Hindu tradition, but in Western tradition and world traditions. This goddess is, how do I say this? If I think of a metaphor for her, all I can think of is like a thundering force. Do you know what I mean? A force that is beyond our imagination in her destruction and regeneration. I would say to me, equaled really only by the fear that humans felt in saying Persephone's name. That makes sense. And that's not dismissing any of the other goddesses we've talked about, because they are all, you know, to be honored. But Kali does this thing that both frightens and attracts you, in which is a fascinating paradox for me, because it's very Gorgon-like. And in fact, if you look at her face, she has the traditional Gorgon face, which the Hellenes, of course, use, which is that kind of big smile with the tongue sticking out. There is something beyond power here. There's something that kind of vibrates a kind of fearsomeness. Yeah. And Kali is certainly that goddess. And so, for example, someone like Yama, who is great, but he's a judge of the dead and determines the faith of the souls. Yeah, he's all right, but it's not Kali. Yeah, let's just put it that way. And Kali continues to be a mystery and continues to be a. And by mystery, I mean that people continue to try to connect with her and find ways to connect with her and then work with that connection, because sometimes that connection is too powerful or sometimes it's too intense or whatever. So a mystery to us to connect with. Yeah. I myself, for example, have not connected to. I feel much more connected to someone like Persephone, but I think that's because that's my own indigenous culture, so to speak, right? And so that resonates with me in an environmental way. Like, so when I go to the temple of Persephone, for example, the mountains, the sounds, the language even is familiar to me. And while I have not visited India, I am sure that the temples or where Kali was worshipped or continues to be worshipped are powerful sites. So you could feel that powerful energy. But I don't feel that ancestral connection, let's say, obviously. Yeah. And I think it's very, very important. Maybe I should take this moment to say that it is very, very important for women and men to reach back to their ancestral tribes, to their ancestral connections, instead of appropriating or pulling or drawing on other cultures. And while I don't want to deny that you can connect to goddesses across the world, because that is not, I can't deny someone's experience, certainly, and it's not my place because I am not a judge. Right. I think it's in, I think there was a long period of 50 to 100 years where Western Europeans, particularly North Americans, actually more than anything, but let's say Western Europeans, North Americans, had been so indoctrinated with Christianity being their past, and I say this in quotation marks, or being their native religion or born into, that perhaps they didn't realize that actually you can reach beyond Christianity quite easily, especially nowadays, to find your own indigenous gods, your own indigenous ancestors, your own tribes, your own religious practices. And that has actually been my goal and my journey for a long time, is to reconnect with the ancestors of my own line. And in fact, now in September, at the end of this month, I'm heading to Romania for a month. And it's the beginning, because you can't do it in a month, but I have other commitments, but it's the beginning. This will be the beginning of my own ancestral journey to connect to the Dacians, for example, the Dacians, who are a tribe that predate the Romans before the Romans arrive and they mess us up. And so my goal is to go to museums and go to ancient sites and blah, 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 as much as I can, and find my indigenous roots, right? We all have indigenous roots. Every single human on this planet has indigenous roots. And by indigenous, I mean people of the land from which you come from, ancestral roots. And so we don't need to borrow or lean on, or at worst, appropriate other cultures. But it is important, for example, in today's episode, that we look cross-culturally, because I think what that shows us is how much more similar we are than different, right? We are very, very similar as humans. And I think sometimes we forget that because we so visually and social medially and all these other ways see difference, right? Anyway, sorry, that was a side rant. My apologies. But I do think it's important that we all learn to look, and I think it's more fulfilling, to be honest. Not to dismiss anyone's connection with any of the goddesses that I'm talking about today, but just to encourage perhaps further research and connection. And now we will go back to European soil and we'll talk about for a minute hell. Now I've got a couple of goddesses left. These are Northern European goddesses. So hell is a Norse goddess. I was going to end with her, but I'm going to share with you a Finnish goddess as well. Hel is the reason why we say hell. So I used to teach a course on Norse slash Viking history. Viking, I'm so glad, has become more popularly known as more of a verb than the name of a culture. So you go Viking, but the culture is Norse. Anyways, I'm not going to do another side rant here, but it's important that we know the difference. But anyway, so Hel is a Norse goddess. She is the daughter of Loki, and of course, she rules over Helheim, the realm of the dead. This is why we say hell in English culture, in English. And it's what's really fascinating for me is that for Norse history, hell was a world of ice and cold. Okay. So she is cast down to the underworld. She's cast down to the world of ice and cold. And she rules over those who die of sickness and old age. Because remember that in Norse mythology, the heroes and heroines, the warrior men and women, would go to Valhalla, which is up in the sky, for a good death or a good afterlife. So those who die of sickness and old age, so basically die in their beds, go down into hell. But what's fascinating, of course, is that hell is cold, right? And in fact, we haven't talked about this, but in fact, in almost all of the stories, maybe Egyptian, not quite so much, but the Greek, the underworld, to the Greeks, the underworld was cold, wet, dark. The Norse, cold, wet, dark. The Aztecs, cold, wet, dark. Well, it's certainly cold and dark. I don't remember if it was wet. And yet, in the monotheistic, in the Judeo-Christian Islam hell, it's burning hot. Yeah. And so I leave that for you to figure out, like, what is, I mean, so there's a long history of burning alive, burning witches, burning, okay? In short, but there is a long, long history of transforming the afterlife from a cold pit to a hot lava pit. Okay. But I find it fascinating that we've named the Christian hell after the Norse goddess Hel and then changed it to a burning fire for all eternity. So Hel is the overseer of everyone who did not die in battle. So you don't want to go and hang out with Hel. My favorite story about Hel, though, is that she is half alive and half dead. Often the depiction are that her top half is alive and her bottom half is skeletal. But as you can see in modern depictions, it's sort of kind of horizontal, no, vertical, a vertical half of skeletal versus. So she is a goddess again that, although she has been sent down to take care of the souls of those who die in their beds, she was a goddess of the outer world, of the upper world as well. And so she is a liminal goddess as well, who can move between the two worlds, although her responsibility, of course, is the realm of these dead people that did not die in battle. And there is no one else. I mean, she's got some helpers in hell. And Loki, for example, is her father, and he does, Loki, as we know, is a god of trickery and chaos and has, fathered other monstrous beings, but he is actually not a guardian of hell. So it is her responsibility to take care of those who did not die in battle. And one could argue that she is the queen, right? She is the queen. I mean, she's got a dog, she's got Grimm, she's got other, there's other aspects of divinities in the underworld of the Norse, but she is the queen and the ruler. She's the one you don't want to see. Well, first of all, as a Norse, as a Norse person, you probably would not want to be down there anyways, because you want to die in battle. But you can imagine that because the Norse were for a long time mostly agriculturalists, many of them actually died in bed, or of old age. I know we have this sort of very HBO Hollywood idea that the Norse went Viking and they died in battle, and that was something that was promoted, certainly. But many of them died in bed. So many, what I mean is that many Norse people would have, men and women would have had to prepare to deal with hell. Yeah. And so again, another goddess that is able to cross the lines between the upper and underworlds and has the responsibility of all of the souls. I don't know. I kind of feel bad for these poor, all of the souls that perhaps lived a very good life, but just didn't die in battle. You know what I mean? So again, a queen of the underworld. Okay. I'm going to leave you with the Finnish goddess Tuonetar. Tuonetar, the goddess of the Finnish underworld. The Finnish underworld is called Tuonela. And she's the wife of Tuoni, who's the god of death, who is often depicted as sort of a grim and foreboding figure. But Tuonetar is the, again, just like you've seen before, the more frightening figure of the two. And it's interesting because they often refer to her as the mistress of Tuonela, so the mistress of the underworld, which I think is an interesting hark back almost to Persephone as mistress or the land of the dead. She transitions. Right? She is said to be born actually in the earthly realm. Okay. And there are some stories that she was actually a real woman, a mortal woman that had all of these insatiable curiosities for life's mysteries. And that she, as she pursued, as she went on these adventures and explorations, she actually went through hidden realms and gained forbidden knowledge. And eventually she kind of stumbled on this ancient rite that gave her the right to access Tuonela, which is the underworld. And so again, you have this woman, first of all, probably a human woman, at least that's how the stories are told, who is an explorer, who is an adventurer, who is in the earthly realm, who finds these secret hidden treasures, hidden gems, finds this right, and stumbles into Tuonela. And it is here that she falls in love with the beauty of the underworld and its eerie tranquility. Okay? She encounters spirits there. Spirits that are trapped in this eternal slumber. She wants to understand their existence, and she seeks the connection between the living and the dead. So, right? Like, again, the complexities of this mystery, right? I mean, the final mystery for all of us is death. Well, perhaps crossing through the veil is part of it, but death is the final mystery. And here we have another divine feminine, or in this case, an earthly woman who becomes a divine feminine, who not only finds the underworld, falls in love with the underworld, and then continues to create this interconnectedness, right? And a Finnish legend tells us that you may actually see Tuonetar walking in the living world. So there's lots and lots of accounts of travelers who meet mysterious women that are cloaked in darkness. And that, for example, there's stories in which these travelers see her, look at her eyes, and then they feel a sense of peace, a sense of guidance. So she is also a goddess that is a goddess of transitions, right? She becomes a symbol of light and darkness. And I really wanted to talk about her, because the one way that she, how do I say this? The one way that she has developed this skill and taken on this power is through learning. So she uses learning and knowledge as a transformative experience. And it allows her access to the outer and on to the upper and underworld. Okay. She is also sometimes known, for example, in Finnish epics, to give tired people drinks of eternal sleep. So to bring, how do I say this? To bring a slow death, a peaceful death to people. Sometimes she is depicted as weaving a web of fate, binding souls of the departed with shadow and silence. So there's also an aspect of magic, kind of witchcraft. There's this idea that she's got this because she has learned the spell, and because she's performed the ritual in order to be part of the underworld and become the queen of the underworld. There's an element of magic and witchcraft about her. So again, very much harkens back to Persephone and the others that we looked at. Now, of course, the counterpart is Tuoni, who is the god of death. And he also helps to govern the realm of the dead. And they are often referred to as Tuoni the Lord, again, the Lord of the Land of the Dead, and Tuonetar, his dread queen. I love that, right? His dread queen rule over the realm of Tuonela. Right. And sometimes they're both referred to as dark rulers of the underworld, and they weave the fates of those who pass into their realm. So, again, one of the concerns I think that humans have, and again, one of the reasons why I wanted to do this episode, because we don't know what happens on the other side of the veil. Many of us, some of us say we do, perhaps they do, but we don't popularly know what happens on the other side of the veil. And I'm going to argue that human beings for the last 10,000 years, perhaps more, didn't know what happened on the other side of the veil. Therefore, these goddesses that run hell, that can go to hell and come back, that are in charge of the fate of our souls, right? Which is eternal, right? I mean, here we've got what, 60, 80 years? Okay, great. But the soul is eternal in the underworld. And so making sure that you respect, honor, worship properly these goddesses of the underworld is the epitome of your, I mean, perhaps the Egyptians got it right. You should spend your life thinking about death, Because number one, then you'd understand how short it is and how irrelevant, a Mercedes might be to some of us. Not picking on Mercedes, sorry, Mercedes, but you know what I mean? Like you begin to think in a different way. But most importantly, you begin to think about who will be a part of the afterlife that I'm going to spend my entire life with, my entire afterlife with. And so the goddesses become key roles. And some of the patterns that you've seen today in sort of wrapping up, goddesses often embody, so goddesses that go to hell often embody life, death, and rebirth. There's a cycle. And that's also actually aspects that could be part of the three phases of Hecate. Yeah. Life, death, rebirth. Okay. There's lots of aspects of the goddesses that deal with transformation, resurrection, protection. They are sometimes intermediaries, they are guides, and they're also rulers, queens of the underworld. Typically, male gods are rulers and judges. So we've seen, right? They personify more absolute aspects of death and the afterlife. So they're more about judgment, destruction sometimes, and the finality of death. And when we see Anubis, for example, he's the transport. He's responsible for the transport. So if I can wrap this up, I would say that gods have a singular, more focused role, gods of the underworld, directly related to governance, governance and order. And goddesses, though, have complexities beyond complexities of multitasking. Of course, afterlife, of course, fertility, love, magic, healing, resurrection, intermediaries, performance of rituals here on this side, in order to so supervising performance of ritual here on this side in order to get to the other side. So to conclude, goddesses who go to hell are primary. We must ask ourselves now, in the modern world, in your own life, who do you honor for the afterlife? Is it Yahweh, the Judeo-Christian Muslim God? Right? Yahweh, God, Allah, same dude. Or is it one of these queens of the underworld, or perhaps one of the judges of the underworld? Do we pay enough attention to preparing? Yeah. Especially in North America, where we live in denial of death. Yeah. In denial of ending. At least this biological 3D self. Yeah. This bio machine ends. So who do we pay attention to? Who do we pay homage to? How do we prepare? And so if you're interested in that, one of these goddesses that we've talked about today would be a great place to start. Yeah. So I want to thank you all for joining me, for watching this episode, for supporting my channel. I am in the process of continuing the mapping project of writing the book on Artemis of Ephesus. I've got a new Substack, so if you want to find me on Substack and you're into writing, I'm writing a bunch of blog posts under Artemis Expert. It's called In Search of Artemis. And so I want to thank you all for all of your support as an academic that is now sort of hold onto a journey that is new in the sense that it is both academic and personal and spiritual and physical. This is somewhat uncharted territory, not totally unique or rare, but it's uncharted. And it's a move in a different way of thinking about my own identity as a professor of university. And while, yes, no one can take away my PhD and my research, I like to think is always a top notch. And certainly I presented at conferences where That seems to be validated. It's a different way of living, of presenting work, of sharing, and I'm really, really, really loving it. And so I hope that we will continue to build community together, and I hope that we will continue to communicate. And like I said, if you'd like to learn more and you'd like to take one of my courses, please join us in the take one of the courses below. There is a workshop coming up on August 17th, although it is a women's workshop. Sorry, guys, about sensuality and feeling your sensuality. So if you'd like to join the Goddess Wisdom workshops, please do so. Again, that's below. But otherwise, feel free to join me on any social media app or on Substack. And of course, thank you for joining me here. And I hope that you have a fantastic weekend. And please leave me comments, leave me thoughts, leave me things that come up, connections that maybe have occurred for you. I really love to hear back from you guys and to interact with all of you who have spent the time watching this. So thanks so much, and I'll see you next time.